Is it our OEA reading group? We're continuing our reading of cybernetics and the origin of information. We're still on chapter one of the book, and we are starting at page 35 of the translation. Yeah, this chapter is about like the different types of what he calls information machines. So he's talking, of course, about electronic computers, which are sort of ancestors of the kinds that we have today, but also a variety of these sort of demonstration devices that cyberneticians had put together. So like the one that he, I think, is most interested in is this automat that Gray Walter had put together, which is a sort of artificial animal. It has this very simple set of feedback mechanisms that actually gives it almost like a simulacrum of animal behavior. So it's a sort of described as sort of resembling a tortoise. Obviously it has wheels instead of legs, because even now, moving, like walking robots are pretty difficult to construct. So obviously in the 60s, much more so. So it's a little sort of tortoise, and it has a photosensitive cell that, so it directs itself towards light. But it has a sort of sweet spot in terms of the intensity of light that it, if the light is too bright, it will move away. But then if it's, not so bright, it will move towards the light. The light that, so the way that's like sort of, set up is, constructed, there's like a charging station for this, artificial animal, that, you know, it has a battery, that it has to charge. And, the light is, used as sort of like a signpost of the charging station. The behavior of this device changes depending on the level of charge in the battery. So if the battery is very low, it's almost depleted, the sort of threshold for the light sensitivity changes. So where previously it would have avoided light of a certain intensity, now with the battery depleted, it's almost as if it's like hungry, and then it's more willing to approach an intense light source if that's where the charging station is. So it's sort of aversion for intense light decreases as the battery charge is depleted. Again, that's obviously a sort of anthropomorphizing way of depicting what's going on, because really it's just a set of circuits that are sort of set up in a certain way to produce this kind of behavior. But as like an observer watching this device, moving around, you sort of have the impression that it's acting like an animal that, has it gets hungry and it sort of has an aversion to light. And then somehow at some point the hunger outweighs the aversion to light to make it actually approach the charging station despite the intense light. I think the last sort of behavior mechanism in this device is that it has a sort of tactile sensor at the front. So if it runs into an obstacle, that sort of disengages the directional mechanism that orients it towards light. So it essentially just moves around at random until it gets around the obstacle, and then it re-engages the directional mechanism with the light, and then sort of returns on its path towards the light source. So like as long as there's no obstacles, it will just keep, it'll just move in a straight line towards the light source. But if it hits something, it will just sort of randomly move around until it gets around the obstacle and then continue back on the straight path. So last time I compared this to something you can imagine like a worm trying to follow a gradient of some sort of like a smell or a chemical gradient of some kind, where it would sort of just move blindly towards the or up the gradient or toward the higher concentration of this chemical. But then it hits an obstacle of some kind, it will just sort of blindly like search around, move its head until it finds a free path, and then keep going forward towards the higher concentration of the chemical. So this is a similar, I guess, kind of seeking behavior, but it's completely undirected. It's not sort of figuring out the nature of the obstacle, what the shape is, etc., and then like figuring out what the ideal path around this obstacle is. It's just like randomly moving until it gets around the obstacle. So yeah, you have these like three very simple kind of feedback loops that structure the behavior of this device. And already, even with these very simple sets of feedback loops, you produce something that is at least comparable to behavior of these animals with like fairly simple nervous systems, you know, a worm or something like that, or maybe some kind of insects, although even a lot of insects have more sophisticated behavior than that. So the question is, like, is this kind of device, this very simple sort of set of, what is ultimately just electrical circuits, you know, put together in a certain way, is this very simple kind of device just a sort of quantitatively less complicated version of what we see in other animals and human behavior? Like, is it the case that you could just sort of build a more complicated version of this that would be like capable of writing symphonies and books about cybernetics and whatever, that, you know, all the sophisticated things that we observe humans doing are just like a more complicated version of this automat? Or is it the case that there's sort of intrinsic difference or a qualitative difference between what we recognize as human understanding of something, like a grasp of the meaning of something or significance of something, and also in other animals that, you know, they are sort of directed towards achieving some kind of end? Is that, you know, qualitatively different from this, you know, very simplistic sort of interaction of different feedback loops? And so that's sort of like what Ruyer is sort of pointing to in his analysis of these kinds of information machines, is this like sort of fundamental question of whether the difference between this automat and a human is just a quantitative one of like degree of complexity, or is an intrinsic fundamental qualitative difference in terms of like the kinds of entities that these things are. And of course, his answer is going to be the second, that yeah, there is this fundamental difference between these simple feedback loops and other simple sort of information machines or machines in general, and then humans and other animals and even living beings as such, you know, that have this capacity to grasp significance in various ways that, you know, obviously are not the same. That, you know, an embryo developing into an adult organism is not sort of thinking of what the adult organism looks like, but it's in some sense, it belongs to the same category as a human being trying to achieve a goal, rather than to the same category as these automats that sort of give a simulation of goal-directed behavior. Okay, so let's continue from page 35, if someone would like to read the next bit.
I can read. So we're starting after the Norbert Wiener quote.
So I think we're right at the line Norbert Wiener has tried.
Okay. Norbert Wiener has tried to improve the way the problem is posed by noting the following. One, that the motor apparatus of the eye and the adjoining brain centers are set up not only to bring onto the fovea an object whose image is first peripheral, but if it is an object of which we are more familiar with one orientation rather than another, to put this image in this privileged orientation. It is unpleasant and difficult to read a page that has been placed wrongly, and we straighten it up as quickly and instinctively as possible. Two, that we recognize an object above all by its contours, where there is a contrast between two regions of different color or brightness. Three, finally and above all, that the different transformations of a shape according to perspective constitute a quote-unquote group, in the mathematical sense of the word, a group itself comprising several subgroups, homogeneous enlargement, affine group, rotation along various axes, translation, and so forth. As a result, just as the Pitts machine or the quote-unquote reader of television explores and scans an ordinary two-dimensional surface, machines can be designed to explore the various subgroups of transformation involved in various perspectives of a given object. Such mechanisms may exist in the brain, combined with the center of foveal fixation. When operating, these group scanning mechanisms must necessarily fall on one of the possible transformations of a standard model stored in our physiological memory, or at least fall within a certain margin of tolerance in order to resonate with the quote-unquote model. This will then allow us to recognize an object as similar, as universal, and to act accordingly. Gray Walter's automaton, equipped with such relay-mounted group scannings, could then recognize its hutch from any point of view. Let us even suppose that one of these group scannings is damaged. The automaton would then appear to suffer from a specific quote-unquote agnosia, quite similar to the various agnoses that are at the root, in particular, of the different forms of sensory aphasia. We know how difficult it is to classify aphasics using psychological terms or properly linguistic classifications. The varieties of aphasia described by Henry Head, verbal, nominal, syntactic, semantic, do not hold up to the facts. But this is perhaps because linguistic behavior, assuming a handling of universals, is based on group scannings of recognition and neural mechanisms that are not organized in a way that corresponds to conscious impressions or to the conceptual analysis of language. Head regretted not having the boldness to speak regarding aphasia of group X of functions, which would be subdivided into, quote, groups A, B, C, and A, B, C, D, unquote. By trying to reproduce in automata the various group scannings of which Wiener speaks for the recognition and handling of language, cybernetics would perhaps allow a mechanical analysis that would reveal itself to be deeper than any psychological one. Without going as far as this, it would in any case be possible to produce mechanical animals that would closely mimic instinctive behavior according to three factors that the experiments of animal psychologists have highlighted: awareness threshold, action according to a thematic melody, and finally, which interests us in particular here, guidance by the perception of specific universals. It would certainly be difficult to imitate mechanically the conceptualized perception of human beings, and to produce a machine that, made to flee from snakes, would not flee from a slow worm, or that, made to hunt birds, would not hunt bats. But it would not be difficult to achieve the degree of perceptive finesse of most animal instincts, triggered or awakened by gnosis of an often very basic character, as shown by the effectiveness of baits and lures. Maybe I'll just read one more paragraph. Nevertheless, cybernetics would be wrong to declare a victory too early and to believe the problem of the perception of forms has been solved. The perception of an object as a quote-unquote universal presupposes in any case that hypothetical group scanning is capable of activating at a certain moment a mnemonic model. Cybernetics can only conceive of this model as materially existing, either in a certain number of determined cells or, according to Carl S. Lashley's very vague conception, throughout the cortex, where it spreads like a wave pattern. However, this activation in turn cannot be said to occur when the quote-unquote mind, esprit, recognizes the similarity of the mnemonic model and the current perception, once duly transformed, because nothing would be gained by reducing the problem in this way. The quote-unquote mind is here only a word or a deus ex machina, which it is the very essence of cybernetics to reject. It will be necessary to admit a resonance similar to physical resonances, both to explain the formation of the schema, the universal, and to explain its reactivation. For example, for me to recognize triangularity in a particular triangle, a model must first have been formed from the previously perceived triangles by eliminating the elements that do not reinforce each other, the values of the angles, the dimensions of the sides. Then it is necessary that the new triangle reactivates the quote-unquote triangularity model. I don't fully understand all of this, but it seems like what he's most interested in is the suggestion from the cyberneticists that a certain kind of like geometric transformations of an object can account for what is basically conceptual schematization, or I guess something like non-conceptual schematization in the case of non-human animals, which is what allows a human or other animal to recognize an object as what it is, despite the fact that it's seeing that object in like unfamiliar conditions, like a plate viewed from the side, for instance. I don't know. Seems skeptical of the possibility of doing this, but I'm not sure I fully understand why, honestly.
Yeah, maybe I'll start by just explaining a little bit what this group theory bit is about. This is a huge topic. Like, group theory is a whole like discipline of mathematics at this point, so I can't really get into a lot of it. But the idea here is that so group theory has, or in relation to geometry, at least, has to do with symmetry. So if you picture, for example, a square, you can, if you rotate the square 90 degrees, either clockwise or counterclockwise, you get another square that looks the same as the first one, assuming the corners are not like labeled in some way. And so you can, for example, set up a set of rotations by multiples of 90 degrees that takes the original square and returns an identical square. Any combination of rotations by multiples of 90 degrees in either direction will leave the square unchanged. This set of rotations is together with the operation of composing the rotations in this way, forms a group. This is in the mathematical sense that he's referring to here. The nature of the group that is associated with an object corresponds to the form of symmetry that the object possesses. So different shapes have different symmetry groups in terms of what kinds of operations you can do on these shapes that leave the shape unchanged. And the idea here is that you could specify, for example, like the shape of a letter, for example, in terms of what kinds of operations leave that letter shape unchanged. So like we as human beings can see the letter A and recognize it as that letter, you know, whether it's big or small, at different angles, etc. We still sort of extract the form of the letter A from the different retinal stimulations that present this form in different ways. So the idea here is, yeah, you would like use this sort of group theoretic understanding of a form as something that is invariant under transformations to sort of expand the ability of these simple machines to recognize some sort of meaningful I shouldn't use the word meaningful here, but to recognize some kind of point of its environment. So like in the example of the automat, so in the very simple Gray-Walter automat, it just aims towards the light source that is at the right intensity range to find its charging station. But you can imagine a more sophisticated form of automat that would have, instead of having just this photosensitive cell that keeps the light stimulation in the right range, you would set up like a camera that is actually generating a picture, and you would have some sort of capacity within the automat to use the video feed to find the charging station. And so to be able to do this, you would have to, the processing of the video feed would have to be able to identify the charging station from a variety of angles. So not just sort of directly in front or one specific angle, but like, you know, viewed from 30 degrees to the left, what does the charging station look like? And so this sort of group theoretic idea is that you could like set up the processing of the video feed to extract the set of transformations of the object that is like the target, for example, the charging station in this case, extract the group of transformations that leaves the form of the charging station invariant, despite the variation in perspective. So I think he, first of all, sees this as not that plausible as like a way to it's not that realizable. I don't think he sees much hope that this is going to actually be successful just empirically. But I think also, I think the more fundamental objection is that conceiving of the capacity to recognize a universal as this kind of physical process involving the extraction of an invariant from varying presentations, like extracting the recognition of the letter from the different sizes and orientations of the letter. If you consider this to be a kind of application of a model to the input, then you sort of run into the same problem that you would have run into if you had an invariant model and didn't have this group theoretic sort of operation happening first. Like the sort of very simplistic idea would be that like you have a goal image within the automat, like this is what the charging station looks like when viewed from directly in front. And then the automat would just sort of compare its input video feed to this target image until they align perfectly. And then it knows that the charging station is in front of it. And then the sort of more sophisticated model that's being proposed here is that you have this group theoretic transformation to extract the invariance of the shape of the charging station from the video feed that would depict the charging station from a variety of angles. But then you still have sort of the same problem, like how does this automat recognize that the video feed coming in corresponds to the sort of extracted form of the charging station under this group theoretic transformation. And this is maybe related to the famous argument in Aristotle against Plato's account of the forms, the third man argument, which is that, you know, if the Platonic theory explains the you know what is common to men in terms of this form of man as such, this, you know, or essence or whatever you want to call it, if there's this universal that is sort of, that underlies each of the particular men, then what is it that is common to the universal man as such and the individual men? It seems like you need a third man that is sort of explains the commonality or what is common between the essence of man, this form of man, and the individual men. And then of course you would need a fourth man to explain all those resemblances and so on. And so here it's the same problem that like you have this form that the automat is supposed to be able to recognize, and now it's not just this like specific form of one particular viewpoint on the charging station, but it's this more abstract form of the invariant shape of the or invariant structure of the charging station, no matter what perspective it's viewed from. But still, you have this problem of how does the automat apply this form to this charging station without having some metaform that tells it like how to like do that application. I think for Ruyer, this is like a problem sort of in principle, no matter how successful or unsuccessful this sort of strategy of extracting invariance ends up being. And I think he also here is sort of pointing to like the problem here is that cybernetics is supposed to be sort of explaining what it is to understand things, to, you know, what is mental life, what is a grasp of meaning and so on. It's supposed to be explaining this in terms of these, you know, feedback mechanisms and so on that are not themselves mental, that like we sort of reduce mental life and the grasping of meaning to something that is not itself meaningful or mental. That's sort of the whole ambition of cybernetics. But then we end up with this situation where this sort of explanatory strategy that is supposed to be telling us how this automat is capable of recognizing its charging station under a variety of perspectives relies on what is a kind of like surreptitious mental life, again, that the automat has to like recognize the fact that this incoming video feed under a certain transformation matches its model of the charging station. So you're kind of smuggling in this mental concept of recognizing a resemblance or recognizing a correspondence, which is exactly what you were supposed to be explaining. Some of the cyberneticians tried to sort of overcome this by invoking concepts of like a physical like alignment or resonance. Sometimes these kinds of terms of the incoming video feed and the stored model of the charging station, that like the sort of incoming information flow would like physically resonate with the stored model, like in the memory of the device or the human being, whatever you're trying to explain. But again, this is like sort of a equivocation between like a physical explanation and then the semantic explanation of the meaning of, you know, a triangle or the recognized shape of the charging station or whatever. And so you're kind of reduced to either bringing back in the mental or semantic kind of concepts that you were trying to explain, and then that means you're not actually explaining them, or you have to kind of like pretend that physical processes are themselves semantic in nature, or that like this resonance, this kind of mysterious resonance, is like itself constitutes a grasp of the correspondence between the video feed and the stored model. So either way, you're kind of not actually explaining. You're either reintroducing what you were supposed to explain, or you're just pretending that the physical thing is actually the thing that you're trying to explain. So it's kind of a dead end for Huiye. And yeah, and there's some discussion in the chat about like to what extent this kind of extraction of invariance strategy would actually even succeed in like sort of reproducing or explaining animal behavior. So Angus had referred also to like the kinds of improvisation that that we had talked about when we were reading The Structure of Behavior, that you know animals are not just sort of like these pre-programmed machines that blindly execute a program, although that you know sometimes does occur, like especially in things like these sort of mating rituals that you see in a variety of animals that are sort of triggered by the perceptual cues that indicate the mating partner's presence. In many cases, animals will not just sort of blindly execute a program, but they will actually sort of flexibly reorient their behavior or adapt their behavior to the environment and, you know, achieve a certain goal based on what is available to them in their surroundings. And this is something that Darwin even observed this in earthworms. He was actually very interested in earthworms, one of his last books. And he talked about how whatever, I don't know what species of earthworm, it was like they would drag leaves into their, burrows or whatever you call them. But he noticed that they were always dragging the leaf with the stem end first. And when he would he would observe an earthworm dragging the leaf in the wrong direction, and then the leaf, of course, like sort of gets stuck as it's like being pulled into the hole, and the worm would sort of reverse and turn the leaf around and then drag it in the right direction. So here we see the worm is like has this goal of dragging a leaf into its nest or whatever it is, but it recognizes that it's not working, and then it figures out how to adapt what it's doing to actually achieve that goal, rather than just sort of blindly following the, you know, pull the leaf program. So this sort of indicates that, you could suppose that there's like a sort of meta program that says like, try to pull the leaf. And then if that doesn't work, turn the leaf around and pull it. So it could be that there's like a pre-programmed, a more complicated program that the worm is executing. And computer programs have these kinds of things, you know, if then conditions and so on. But like the more sort of variety of situations animals are capable of adapting to, the less plausible it is that there's like a set of conditions that are like pre-written, that is just sort of, going through this list of conditions to figure out which one applies in a given situation. At least makes questionable the idea that there is this kind of that we can understand animal behavior and human behavior as well, and in particular in terms of this kind of execution of a program as opposed to adaptation to an environment. And I know we've been on this one passage for a long time now, but one last thing I think is worth mentioning in this context here is I was thinking the other day about this term that Merleau-Ponty uses, and that Huiye has kind of made similar comments about this idea of a melodic grasp, that like an animal's behavior is a kind of melodic understanding or something along those lines. And I was thinking about like how maybe what I was thinking of when we were reading Merleau-Ponty was a more sort of like classical music melody, where you have like something written on the page or like pre-composed that you execute. But it might be better to think of it as almost like a jazz improvisation, where the actual contour of the melody is not like preset that you are kind of generating it as you go along. But obviously that doesn't mean that like as an improviser, you can just play whatever, because there's like good and bad improvisation. There are, you know, better and worse ways of ending a phrase that you started. The actual realization of this melody hasn't been determined at the outset. So it's part of there's a kind of internal evolution where each stage of the improvised melody kind of elicits the next one without actually determining it. And so it's kind of strange, like not sort of random, but not determined development from one part to the next in this like intrinsically connected flow, I guess, if that makes sense. Yeah, so maybe you can ask your cat what kind of theme they're improvising next time you speak to them. Okay, so we can go on to the next bit on page 37 if someone else would like to read.
Yeah, you can read. Such a hypothesis is extremely unsatisfactory, not to mention the difficulty of applying it to temporal universals, a dance or melody, or to things that cannot be reduced to a structural schema, for example, a quote-unquote friendly attitude. It is quite beside the psychological reality. When I recognize a plate, even when viewed from the side, the plate remains an elongated ellipse, or trapezium, although I know it is round. According to the hypothesis, the final consciousness, after the intervention of the group scanning mechanisms and the resonance with the cerebral model, should be that of a round plate. The immediate experience reveals a kind of combination of a very particular character, where the sensory image is similarly transfigured by knowledge, but it is not transformed, strictly speaking. It is a serious issue that cybernetics is thus led to disqualify the testimony of consciousness to such an extent. We can admit that the emotional atmosphere, or even the atmosphere of meaning, is not always essential in behavior. We can also admit that even the psychological interpretations of gnosis or agnosia are sometimes superficial. But in the perception of the plate, triangle, or hats, it is difficult to reject an immediate intuition. We see the particular triangle, at the same time and indissolubly, as triangle and as particular. A resonance does not make the quote-unquote three angles appear by blurring everything else. We see the plate as a circle seen obliquely, obliquely, not as a circle or as a straightened ellipse. The study of what psychologists call the constants of perception reveals that the atmosphere of meaning, at least in this particular case, is not a vague epiphenomenon, but an effective component of perception, which obeys precise laws. The least we can say is that it is really too early to declare, with FSC Northrop, that the machines for perceiving universals have a quote-unquote revolutionary significance for natural science, moral as well as natural philosophy, and for one's theory of the normative factor in law, politics, religion, and the social sciences, end quotes. That they allow us to, open quotes, overcome the dualism of mind and matter, end quotes, of fact and value. The Gestaltists had already been too eager to announce that they had resolved the same question. I don't know if I should keep reading, or maybe we can stop here a bit and I will continue reading after.
Let's stop here for now. Yeah, you can read the next one as well. Yeah, it's a short section before this heading. This is a pretty important point, I think, that that Merleau-Ponty also mentions repeatedly in the Phenomenology of Perception. I can't remember if it came up in Structure of Behavior, but this idea that like when we perceive an object, we have, you know, color constancy, shape constancy, etc. But that doesn't mean that we sort of eliminate the variability. This example of the plate, like the plate is circular. You know it's circular. You see it from a particular angle, unless it's like held up perpendicular to your eyes. You will see the plate at an angle, which means that the projection on your retina is actually an ellipse and not a circle. But at the same time, you don't see either the plate as elliptical. It still looks like a circular plate, sort of removing the obliqueness of the plate to produce like a circular image. neither of those is the case. You actually see the plate as a circular plate seen at an angle. That's just sort of like an irreducible perception of circular plate seen at an angle, rather than an elliptical plate, which of course we don't see, or a circular plate with the angle sort of eliminated from the perception. So it's this, it's hard to sort of express exactly what it is, but it's like, it just looks like a circular plate seen at an angle. You can't like sort of decompose it into the circularity or the angle side and like eliminate one or the other. Merleau-Ponty also talks about like this example of like when you look at railroad tracks and, you know, or like any sort of perspective involving like a straight line extending out to the horizon. In some sense, you can say that it looks like the railroad tracks are converging as they approach the horizon. But at the same time, it doesn't look like the tracks are actually converging. Like you see the tracks, you know that they are not physically converging. And if you like were to walk along the tracks, that the tracks would not converge, because it would actually look quite different if the tracks were converging, were physically converging towards a point, compared to the sort of perspective convergence that we see. So like it's hard to actually describe what exactly it looks like, but like converging towards a point in perspective is how parallel tracks look. So that's like this sort of cybernetic explanation that would involve like extracting invariance or something like that is sort of ignores the actual like experience of what it's like to see a plate in at an oblique angle, or what it's like to look at railroad tracks converging in the distance. And so Bass brings up this point that we talked about many times in reading the structure of behavior, that like part of like one important piece of evidence for like the nature of perception is like how difficult it is to actually draw things that on some accounts of perception should be like immediate, that like if our perception is like sort of immediate, if our visual perception, for example, is sort of immediately just this two-dimensional projection on our retina, and then we have to infer the third, you know, the dimension of depth, then it should be very easy to just like draw what is projected on our retina. And it's actually very difficult, that like anyone who has like taken a drawing lesson will recognize that, like drawing a perspective, even of a simple, like a cube or something, is quite difficult, and, you know, much less, you know, a human body or an animal that has this very complex and subtle shape. So like the fact that we have to sort of learn how to see things that we supposedly should be seeing immediately is evidence that this theory that says we see these things immediately is wrong. So Ruyer is making the same kind of argument here, that like this perception of the plate seen obliquely, which is neither sort of a discarding of the obliqueness, nor is it a sort of inference from the elliptical retinal projection. This like for a cybernetic explanation involving this kind of, you know, group theoretic extraction of an invariant, it doesn't do justice to our actual experience of that circular plate seen obliquely as a sort of unified, irreducible, inseparable experience. Bats, do you want to go through the next bit? I'm not sure. Scanning ahead here. You can read up to the next section heading, conditioning and learning.
Yeah, sure. Okay. The balance of interests and compensatory actions. When a dog wants to grab a piece of meat, but is afraid of its master's stick, the stick becomes an obstacle that needs to be avoided. Or the animal can choose a less dangerous way to achieve its goal. An internal obstacle plays a similar role to that of an external obstacle. If the dog has a paralyzed or painful leg, it can keep moving on the other three, or press only lightly on the ground with the sensitive leg. Gray Walter's tortoise does not really take the obstacle into account. It does not really balance the obstacle against the quote-unquote goal. Contact with the obstacle closes a circuit whose action momentarily replaces that of the phototropic circuit. To truly imitate the balance between two possible actions, not only feedback is needed, but a system of compound feedback. Dr. Asby's homeostat is a device made up of four identical elements. each of which reacts to the other three. Each of which reacts to the other three. One element has a movable galvanometer that controls the plunging of a metal wire into a conductive container with a gradient of potential. As each galvanometer receives the output current of all the others, not to mention, of course, its own output current, the balance of each depends on the balance of the whole. If the experimenter disrupts one of the elements by blocking the needle of its galvanometer, for example, the rest of the homeostat adapts to this new situation. It seeks and finds a way to reach the quote-unquote prescribed position of equilibrium. Furthermore, before reaching the windings of an element, the output currents pass through selectors mounted in quote-unquote tiered functions, which themselves represent feedback. These suddenly modify the main feedback when, due to a mechanical obstacle introduced by the experimenter, it would tend to take an extreme position instead of seeking the optimal equilibrium. The selector searches for the secondary feedbacks that are suitable for the main feedback to accomplish its quote-unquote mission, and for the device to search for and achieve the prescribed equilibrium again. ASBI's device is capable of truly extraordinary feats. Suppose that the experimenter reverses the conductors of one of the feedbacks so as to make it positive instead of negative, and makes it work like a reverse acting ball regulator that would accelerate or stop the steam engine instead of adjusting its speed. The selector then intervenes on its own to look for the feedback that will correct or switch off the reverse feedback and restore balance. If the experimenter connects the needles of two galvanometers with a rigid rod, the apparatus is also capable of restoring stable equilibrium, to the point that when the connection rod is removed, the apparatus must again grope around to find the previous assembly, montage. This is a little like a man who is healed but is disoriented because he has become used to his disease. There are corresponding operations in the physiological order. If a dog's two left legs are connected with a rigid rod, it will be able to walk again, although with difficulty. If we surgically switch the internal and external straight muscles of the eyeball in a monkey, as in Marina's already old experiment, or if we switch the flexor and the extensor of the animal's arm, like Roger Sperry, the normal movements are restored, very quickly for the eye, more slowly for the arm, after a period of incoordination. Kurt Kofka made a big deal of Marina's experiment. He saw in it proof of the existence of a regulating dynamic field, independent of the nervous, quote-unquote, rails. Kurt Goldstein considers similar cases of compensation after an injury or deficiency to be evidence of his organicism, Ganzheitliche, and of the independence of performance in relation to the activity of parts. It must be admitted that ASBI's homeostat brings a truly sensational element to the debate. His homeostat works by a set of conductors and not by a quote-unquote free dynamic field, and yet he very precisely realizes the organic regulation that occurs after Marina's experiment. This regulation can now be interpreted as an automatic change of nervous feedback and not as the effect of a rebalancing of a cortical gestalt. If the conflict between Kafka's interpretation and ASBI's does not appear to be very serious, after all, the actions and interactions of feedback are dynamic phenomena, it is above all against Goldstein's organicism and holism that the achievement of the homeostat seems to provide a decisive argument. The homeostat is obviously only a machine, and yet it acts as a whole that would be independent of its parts, of their damages or accidental constraints. We can easily imagine the philosophical developments of a Ganzheit theorist or organicist, a disciple of Goldstein, on the performances of ASBI's machine, if we tricked him into interpreting them while hiding that they are the actions of a machine. He would obviously see a... Okay, this is kind of difficult, I'm going to do my best. He would obviously see a Tendenz zum geordneten Verhalten with Ausschaltung von Defekten. He would point out how, open quotes, every change in one place implies a simultaneous change in another place, end quotes, and how die Verhalten Aber sie denen wäre der Rungen sind ein Einheit. We certainly do not claim that Asby's mechanistic theory is fundamentally true, but we recognize that cybernetics here scores a point against anti-mechanistic theories. Asby considers his device to be an analog of the couple formed by the brain and the environment, the brain having to adapt to accidental and unpredictable variations in the environment, but it can also be considered as capable of seeking a balance of interests. The automaton seems to calculate its behavior in the manner of a hedonist, or according to the formulas of marginalist theory. Undoubtedly, for the moment, homeostatic automata do not make real utilitarian calculations. Despite their groping around, their adaptation to circumstances is instantaneous, or at least quote-unquote presentist. We mean that they cannot plan the outcome of their possible action before they accomplish it. They only do physical experiments, not quote-unquote mental ones. But it is not excluded that it would be possible to construct some superimposed automata of which the homeostat would only represent one part, equivalent to the quote-unquote speculating cortex, the other part then using the results tested by the homeostat. The operations of seeking equilibrium and reconciling interests would first take place in miniature before being carried out on a large scale. Some already existing industrial processes can give us an idea of what this quote-unquote mechanical mental experiment, if we can associate these words like this, would look like. Boven locks in Strasbourg, controlled by hydroelectric boxes, where the pressures on both sides of the bulbs are reproduced on a metallic membrane, and the network analyzer, a reduced model of all the connections of an electrical distribution network, which makes it possible to study the various problems of stability posed by accidents or unexpected demands in the power supply.
Right, so here this is a more sophisticated kind of device that, again, is relatively simple in construction, but does things in a way that is much more flexible than the artificial tortoise example that we talked about earlier. So the details of the construction are not that important, but what is interesting is that this still relatively simple device is capable of adjusting not just to different kinds of input, like for example, like the way the tortoise can encounter an obstacle and then adjust its behavior in such a way as to get around the obstacle. But here, the internal functioning of the device can also adjust itself. So you can change the feedback mechanism of one of these elements, in one of the four elements that make up this homeostat. And then the interaction of all four with each other kind of restructures itself automatically so that this reversed feedback in one element is compensated by the action of the others to still, keep this equilibrium. And he compares this to these like physiological examples where, switching the connections of the muscles to the eye results relatively quickly in, a restructuring of the behavior to produce the same outcome. So obviously once immediately after the surgery, tracking of an object by the eye is disorganized, where an object moving towards the right will produce an eye movement towards the left because the muscles have been reversed. But after a short time, the tracking gets restructured so that the eye is still or is once again capable of tracking an object, now with the opposite muscles doing the movement or generating the movement. And you can think of anyone who's had like an injury, for example, that like you have to not only recover, like actually just sort of physically heal the damaged muscle or whatever it is, but also, learn how to organize your movements in a new way. So that can mean a lot of physiotherapy in the case of a more serious injury actually involves not just the strengthening of a muscle, but reorganizing a pattern of movement that you have to learn how to walk in a different way now that you have a prosthetic, for example, or you have to sort of, you just have to sort of relearn to like produce this structured behavior, whether it's keeping your balance or walking in a regular way or whatever. Now that you have a different set of circumstances in the functioning of your body that you have to adapt to. And Huye takes this to sort of call into question maybe a too hasty organicism. Like he talks about Goldstein and Kafka as like that both of them had emphasized this kind of holistic or organismic nature of their accounts of behavior, where so they had like emphasized some of these types of experiments where like the eye adapts to the switched muscles as demonstrating a kind of structuring quality of the whole organism, that like the actual functioning of these individual parts, the individual muscles and the nerve muscle circuit that is involved in moving the eye, these are not essential, and what is essential is the whole structure of the organism that is capable of responding and adapting to the changes in the functioning of these individual parts. And Goldstein gives like a sort of a thought experiment where you can imagine that like you present the behavior of one of these automats, homeostats that has this kind of like flexibility and self-adjusting properties. You present this behavior to one of these theorists and they would give the exact same kind of account of the, you know, holistic and organismic nature of this entity, even though really it's actually this very simple sort of set of electrical circuits that can be fully explained in terms of like just the principles of flow of electricity. You don't need to appeal to anything like an organismic nature that would sort of direct the functioning of the whole. So he sees that as a kind of like cautionary example that like we can't like conclude too hastily from this flexibility and, you know, self-transformative capacity that we observe in animals. We can't conclude from that to this like holistic or organismic account of animal behavior in this very direct way. We have to be more careful. And he mentions here, like in this last paragraph, he talks about how even this homeostat, of course, is more sophisticated than the artificial tortoise, but it's still presentist in as is the term that he uses. So it's still only responding to current inputs and just adapting to them automatically, immediately. But then we can imagine like an even further sophistication, which would allow for a device that would like try out different combinations internally first, or different responses to some situation. It would try them out internally first and then execute only the correct one, or the one that ends up producing the desired result. And he mentions a few instances of actual technical devices that were in existence at the time he's writing in the 50s and 60s that operate along these lines. And so this network analyzer, I think that might have been at Bell Labs, if I remember correctly. But anyway, it's a kind of analog computer. It's so you have like an electrical power system, and then you have like in the control center of this power system, you have a miniature model of the electrical power system that simulates the functioning of the real scale system. So you can like see, you know, what would happen if this generator was damaged and could only produce 30% of its output. How would the flow of electricity in the whole grid change in response to that change of output to this one generator? Or what happens if this transmission line is cut? What would happen to the whole system? And there's also, I think this came probably much later, but there's some evidence that there are actually sort of simulation type processes like that in the human brain. That like, so for example, when you reach out to grab a cup or something like that, you are you have like nervous impulses that travel down your arm and stimulate your muscles, and then you have proprioceptive nerves within your muscles, and that are sort of sending impulses that corresponds to the angle of your joints and the degree of flexion of your muscles and so on, sending all that back up to your brain. But this is actually much too slow to sort of fluidly control movements that, like, if you had to sort of make one step of the movement, one, I don't know, move your hand a millimeter and then wait for the signal to pass to your muscle and then make the movement and then have the proprioceptive signal come back to your brain and then move the next millimeter. If you had to do this at each step, you would not be able to move in anywhere near the speed and fluidity that we are capable of. And so there's some evidence that our voluntary movements kind of produce like a simulated copy in our brains as we are moving. So like when you say like, you know, move your arm to pick up the cup, you have like a little analog model going on inside your brain of like what your arm movement will be. And then you're sort of directing the ongoing movement of the arm based on this analog model inside your brain, as well as the proprioceptive feedback. And this also sort of helps to explain like why, like there are situations where things don't go as planned. Like if you like sort of, if you're grabbing the coffee cup and then you trip at the same time, right, your hand will still, your hand movement reaching for the cup keeps going, even though like you're already falling, right? And it takes a little while before you can sort of adjust your behavior to the new input and then, you know, respond in an appropriate way. So there's like this time lag between like the command going to your arm muscles and then the incoming information that like your angle of your body to the cup is no longer the same, and then like readjusting the movement of the arm to match or to correspond to that. So there's like, it's much more complicated than just like this sort of input output loop that you might like simplistically imagine. So again, this is something, so Huye is again not like sort of rejecting this kind of explanation in terms of this like homeostatic model and this kind of automatic adjustment and so on. And I think he would like fully appreciate like these much later developments in neuroscience about like the kind of use of the of this principle inside the human nervous system. But I think he sees it as like a kind of illusion to think that this is going to like account for everything or to like eliminate the need for an understanding of grasp of meaning as such, that like you could use this kind of model of explanation or this kind of explanatory strategy to account for everything that human beings do, or even other animals for that matter.
That's very interesting. I think I mentioned in a previous call that I've been reading some Matter and Memory, and in the beginning of Matter and Memory, Bergson talks about the extent to which perception can be completely explained in terms of what I think he refers to as like molecular excitations in the brain. And, you know, even though he's writing much earlier than Ruye and presumably much earlier than the experiments on proprioception that you were mentioning, he still thinks that, these, what he refers to as like sketches of movements, are basically entirely mechanical. And he has this this evocative image of, if we could see kind of perception from just from the side of the physiological, what it might look like. And he talks about being like backstage behind backstage in a theater and watching the actors, go on to the stage from one side and come back on another, and compares this to these sketches of possible movements that I guess the brain is constantly tracing out.
Yeah, I think this is also related to some, I don't know this stuff that well, but there were some people around this time. I know William James had some like ideas in this direction as well, that like part of what we think of as sort of inner thought, as like, the grasp of the meaning of a word, for example, would actually be like a kind of like a covert movement that, or like the sort of sketch of a movement that like William James even talks about like the meaning of or as being a kind of, you know, set of sensations and like sketches of movement. So obviously like a disjunction is a very abstract logical relationship, but even that he saw as a kind of like having this like motor quality to it or motor representation sort of corresponding to it. But I think Bergson might be sort of working with that idea as well, that like that our sort of mental life, even the very abstract elements of our mental life has this kind of motor quality to it. And I think it is in Matter and Memory where he gives us like sort of analogy of the brain as a switching station, like a telephone switching station. You remember like the old fashioned, you know, telephone exchange where like you have to actually talk to the operator and say like, connect me to whoever. And then the operator would, you know, unplug the jack from one, you know, physically take the jack out of one connection and plug it into a different one. Yes, exactly. There's a little GIF that Bats has posted of this kind of typical switching board the brain kind of does the same thing where like you have these input output connections where like, a certain perception elicits a certain behavioral response. And then the brain is sort of in the middle that, you know, making and unmaking these connections in different ways to produce the behavior that sort of brings about goals or desired states. I think what Mie is talking about here is a similar idea, but like the switching board analogy already gives like a bit of I don't know if this is how Bergson would have thought about it, but like it already adds a kind of suggestion of like selection between a preset collection of options that like you can either, you know, that like in the switching exchange, there are a limited number of telephone numbers that can be connected to each other, although the set of permutations increases pretty quickly, but it's still a finite number. So you can't like call someone who doesn't have a telephone line set up yet, right? The connection has to sort of pre-exist before you can actually make that call. Whereas in the case of even these sort of homeostat devices, the connections are themselves sort of fluidly generated by the interaction of the elements. It's almost as if like your attempt to make a phone call would generate the connection. But I think for Ruyer, that more fluid, dynamic switching board, like you can imagine almost like a liquid switching board, if that image is helpful at all. But that like liquid switching board would not sort of be fundamentally different than the, you know, more rigid switching board. It's just like a more sophisticated, more flexible, more dynamic version, but it still doesn't sort of get to the fundamental problem of grasping meaning or significance. I'm gonna suggest that we actually stop a bit early today. The next bit, the next like section between headings is pretty long. It's like five or so. Actually, it takes us to the end of the chapter. If that's okay with everyone else, we can stop here for today. I have something that I need to get to.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
Okay, cool. So everyone, make sure to equilibrate your components, do all your dynamic homework, and then we will keep going next week and flexibly adapt to whatever adjustments the text throws at us.
I like that sign out was itself a flexible adjustment to the reading for today.